Today on Entrepreneurs Worldwide, our special guest started off his career in the 80s working for Peter Cadbury, one of the country's original corporate raiders.
What was going through your head at that time?
I was just having fun.
You were just having fun.
So I was swanning around London age 20 in brand new Aston Martins. And,
okay. Did you have family money? Were you born with a silver spoon?
Absolutely
what
not.
What age did you leave school?
I realised I was a salesman at heart. I mean, some people think the word salesman conjures up, you know, you drive around in a Retmobile.
Every entrepreneur is a salesman.
He then went on to lead operations across Africa, working as COO for Temenos, the global banking technology giant.
In those days, a gigabyte of disk cost $100,000. I mean, you know, your telephone has 256 of these.
Yeah.
It was the days when, you know, a second-hand computer cost £4.5 million. You know, these were just the processor, not the disk or anything. That was just the processor. When George stepped up as chairman, he put this gentleman in. It's extraordinarily successful. I mean, he took Temenos from its 150 million turnover to its 3 million.
He then goes on to become CEO of Kuka's Holdings, amongst many other roles.
What is your background?
I probably didn't think of it this way at the time, but if I look back on it, you need to sit down with as many people in a company as you possibly can.
Very true.
And understand, because they principally fall into two grades, those who want a job and those who want a career.
He is a serial CEO and a man that's turned many businesses around.
In about 2000, I was offered a job working for in the dot-com boom, and came with 275,000 share options at $3 a pop. This was unpublic. It was, you know, that was what it was. And I didn't take it. And it went public about 6 months later at $23 a go. And at the end of that day, it was $103 a day. And in my mind, I had missed the opportunity on $27 million.
We are so delighted to welcome Julian Sturton to Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
And it's very good to be here.
Peter Cadbury was a name that even I knew as a young man in the 80s, a giant of his time. So talk me through working for him, and how did you get a job working for him?
Actually, I was hoping to go and fly aeroplanes for BA, and they'd closed their school in Hamble. But they said, whatever you do, get fit. So I found an advert in the Evening Standard for driver wanted for television company in Sloane Square. And I thought this would be, you know, pumping great big televisions into people's apartments. And it actually turned out to be Peter Cadbury's driver. And I went for the job, and he was a great aviator, and I got the job as his driver, which was a bit of a surprise to me, and I think to him as well.
What age were you then?
I suppose I was 20 years old.
So Knowing what you've got on your CV and what you went on to achieve, were you a bit of a loss at that stage?
And I thought this was a six-month job before I went and joined BA. BA actually closed their flying school because they had too many pilots. So I had a job. And slowly, because we got on pretty well with Peter Cadbury, he would buy into small companies and he'd leave me. And I was the guy with the big badge, which said, I'm from corporate and I'm here to help. But basically, I was his sneak to find out what was going on. But so actually, that went on in various companies, educational video and small companies. And eventually, we bought into a computer broking company. This was something that in the 80s, people didn't realize. In those days, a gigabyte of disk cost $100,000. I mean, you know, your telephone has 256 of these.
Yeah.
If you bought from IBM, it came with a lifetime warranty. So we would trade these. This was something like secondhand car dealing, but in the computer era. You could buy a computer unseen if it had this magic letter from IBM saying it was original. And he guaranteed it would work when you put it in somewhere else.
So is this from building a relationship with Peter Cadbury?
Yes.
He must have trusted you to be his driver.
I introduced him to this company, which he bought into. I had a friend who was working there, and they were looking for a bit of money. And in 85, he wanted out, and the company was sold to a bigger computer broking who took me with all the assets of the company.
So what was your title at this point?
Oh, I was a nobody. So I was trading computers.
Right. You were winging it.
We were. We'd sell things without having them to sell, and then we'd have to go and find one.
Peter Cadbury is a well-known name, but there are some other names. Was it Tiny Rowland as
Tiny
well?
Tiny Rowland, Gerald Ronson.
Right, so talk us through those kind of men back in the day as business entrepreneurs.
They were real characters. They were, I mean, I suppose you do have them now, but they were pretty revolutionary. They were pretty extraordinary too. They'd do the New Year's Day lunch in Zermatt with the people from Annabelle's and things like that. It was a much smaller group of very high earning or high net worth. And they all had their own helicopters, which in those days
had
was
they
rare,
inherited that money, do you think?
I think to a degree some of them had. I don't think all of them had. A lot of them just made it because they raided and split up companies.
Tell me about how they were raiding companies and how that used to work. It's very different now, isn't it?
It is, but the principles are
they're
the
not
same.
Disrupting, are they?
No.
They're raiding.
Well, some of them were breaking them up. Peter Cadbury bought Keith Prower's ticket agency, which was basically on the rocks, and he put enough money in it to get it going and then sold it for a great deal of money. You know, some of the... Gerald Ronson was a huge car dealership, which he grew out of effectively bankruptcy. They were the characters of their time, and they were always up to mischief and one sort of. They all either had pet tigers or pet snakes or things like that. And there's a lovely story about Peter Cadbury had a pet python, just a baby one, which he took into Annabelle's and gave it to Mabel on the door. Mabel put this box on the radiator at one end, and all the coats were now.
Oh my God.
So they were the characters. I don't think you have those people anymore.
No,
it's too regulated.
Those were the days you could buy those animals in Harrods.
It was, you know, totally illegally, I'm sure. They used to see if they could get to the Severn Bridge in under an hour from Harrods, which one or two of them managed to, you know. But that, I think it was a factor. The 80s, if you remember, particularly in the advertising world, was an extraordinary thing. People were doing fantastic. And Cadbury believed any news was good news. Didn't matter if it was good or bad. If you were in the papers, you were doing the right thing. And there was a rivalry between that sort of group of people. They always wanted to be that much smarter or that much...
What was going through your head at that time?
I was just having fun.
You were just having fun.
So I was swanning around London age 20 in brand new Aston Martins.
Okay. Did you have family money? Were you born with a silver spoon?
Absolutely not.
What age did you leave school?
Absolutely. I left school with A-levels. I never went to university.
Why?
I wanted to go and earn my own money.
Right.
And I didn't know really what I wanted to do. I loved flying. I learned to fly. I got my license with... we had a deal with Peter Cadbury that he... every night I did overtime, instead of paying me overtime, he'd give me a flying lesson. He'd pay for a flying lesson.
Oh, what a cool guy.
And he had his own aeroplanes. And I stayed too long, but you can't complain because having stayed too long, I ended up where I wanted to be. And where I wanted to be was... Well, I didn't know I wanted to be, but it's led to opportunities, and I firmly believe you need to take these opportunities when they're presented.
Were you sort of his gopher?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can think of worse gopher jobs than driving around his Aston Martins in London.
Not only that, but I was sadly, nobody saw it, but I walked into Asprey's one day and I was such a regular visitor, the doorman said, "Good morning, Mr. Sturton."
See, that's brilliant.
You know, so
did you learn much from him?
I learned a great deal.
What did you learn from him?
He was one of the few people, I believe, who got privatised shit of the year twice in a row.
Nice.
Because he was a charming, charming man. But you know, it used to rile some people. And I, certainly in the early days, I reckon I would see a bad deal coming because I'd probably seen it being given by him in some times. But he was a charming man. If he wanted to be his friend, he was the greatest friend you wanted to. But I wouldn't want to be on the one side of him.
Build your values and your principles coming away from men like that?
Well, what was interesting was that having... introduced him to this company and then he wanted to get out. That was the point at which I moved with the residual broking company to the bigger one. So that was the end of my time. And I then spent 4 years with this company called DataServe down in Windsor. And it was the days when, you know, a second-hand computer cost £4.5 million. You know, these were just the processor, not the disk or anything. That was just the processor.
How much of your career has actually just been about showing up and asking? Can I do it?
I realized I was a salesman at heart. I mean, some people think the word salesman conjures up, you know, you drive around in a Retmobile. And
I think every entrepreneur is a salesman.
But, you know, if you know how to sell, because having done years at DataServe, I then was very lucky. I moved to a company called SSA, and SSA was the largest ERP software house at the time for IBM equipment. And ERP is like SAP. Everybody's heard of SAP.
Everyone's heard of IBM and SAP.
Yeah, and SSA was bigger than SAP at the time. SAP came through like a freight train. And there was SSA in Europe was set up by two ex-IBMers. And in the 80s and 70s and 80s, if you wanted the best sales school in the world, you went to Xerox or you went to IBM. And they were where, if you had that on your CV, you were absolutely
in. So what was the background to their sales principles? What was the foundation they were
trying? The IBM sales school was legendary, as was Xerox, actually. They taught people how to satisfy. IBM was a company of 450,000 people in those days.
So what was your role when you started there? What was your title?
As a salesman, looking after the French affiliate and the Spanish affiliate.
Can you speak French and Spanish?
I can speak French, but the Spanish just have to learn
you
to speak English.
You can now, or you
I always have done, because we lived in Switzerland as a child.
Ah, so okay. That's right.
But there was a guy there called Richard Morgan Evans, who is one of my great mentors. He was a legend in IBM, and he used to joke. He said, to sell, you've got to learn a bit about the product, and you've got to be sincere, and we can teach you sincerity.
Do you know, Julian, I'm not very impressed by your mentors. I can't say that.
I love them.
Of course you do. You're a man.
IBM had this thing called President's Club, which is if you did your quota, you went on President's Club. And then they had a thing called Golden Circle. And the Golden Circle was the top 50 people in the company of 450,000 people. And Richard ran it seven times.
Wow.
So nobody's what kind of commissions were people earning?
Oh, it wasn't so much about, I mean, they were earning good money and we were all earning good money, no question at all about it. But SSA, because Richard joined, he brought with him a whole lot of IBMers who were being let go with great packages. So we had a mini extraordinary time. We really had an extraordinary time. We were winning business all over the place. SAP came past us about 7 years later.
How old were you then?
I suppose I must have been in my 30s.
So how did you end up a CEO? I mean, you've basically gone a witchy road.
I was operations manager in SSA, and I left them in, they were bought by one of the Baby Bell companies in the States, and it ceased to be fun. I mean, it was really good fun. We had a wild time.
Because you hung out in Annabelle's for years, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
was in the days when Annabelle's was Annabelle's.
Well, it was Annabelle's, absolutely. And we, and I then left them and I joined Temenos, the world's biggest banking software, even
That's
now.
Greek tycoon, isn't it?
Yeah. And George I'll give you a bit of history about Temenos. Is that what we use?
Please, yeah. Yeah.
It was a bankrupt company in 1993. And George Koukis, who was a penniless Greek in his early days.
Really?
Bought it for $1 million. Everybody said, don't do this. They had seven customers and 14 staff. And it was called Cost Software. And he said, I can do this. He'd been in Hong Kong for a long time. He was an extraordinary man. He bought penniless, went to Australia on a £10 POM ticket in 1968 with a pregnant wife, made a fortune there, lost it in the stock market, and then went to Hong Kong. And then he bought Temenos in November 93. And he took it public in 2001 at $1.4 billion, which was, even now, is a big bummer.
Do you think that's just a case of fortune favors the bold?
To a degree, yes. Absolutely. He took some real risks. Perhaps a little story, which is in his memoirs, is he was selling to Credit Suisse. Well, I shouldn't probably mention their name, but he was. They said, look, you were a bankrupt company. We want your software. How much for the company? And he said, my daughters and wife are for sale, but my company is not. And the fellow said, what do you mean? He said, well, you can't afford it. And he said, I'm Credit Suisse. Of course I can afford it. And he wouldn't. But he'd done a bit of prep work on the guy he was talking to. He knew he liked cigars. So while he was thinking about this, he said, can I smoke? He said, yeah. The chap from the bank said, yes. So he pulled out a cigar and he said, would you like one? And they sat there puffing away on their cigars. And he said, you're not going to sell, are you? And George said, nope. So he signed the contract there and then.
So sales orientated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sales oriented. The first thing I did with Temenos was I joined on the 10th of September 2001, which, if you remember, is the day before the towers came down.
Yeah. Yes.
We lost two offices in the towers and not a single employee.
How?
They were below the floors.
Wow.
They're one in each tower. And I was brought on to sort out a technology company up in Hemel Hempstead, which they wanted. I sorted that out. I then became the...
Okay, what does sorting that out look like?
It was far too big. It had a sales-driven, but no sales. But the technology underlying it was why the Temenos had bought it, because they needed that to run their software. It had a very strange database, and they needed that multi-layered database to do it. So regrettably, one of the first things I did was shut their Portland office, which was doing nothing. Having 6 months, getting it back to a point where actually it was selling a little bit and supporting some customers, but principally it was the technology arm of Temenos.
So you really have been to what would be classed as the school of life, where you have been dived into situations and learnt in a vertical.
Yeah. And you know, as technology moves on and everybody says, well, there's a new world and it's the gig economy, the basics are still the same.
A lot of people can't just walk into something and end up sorting out companies. So what is your background?
I probably didn't think of it this way at the time, but if I look back on it, you need to sit down with as many people in a company as you possibly can.
Very true.
And understand, because yes, they principally fall into two grades, those who want a job and those who want a career. And I've met somebody recently who has followed this very, very successful, way more successfully than me. And he put it into words for me. But those who want a career, you need to look after. Those who want a job, if you can afford it and they're useful, let them stay. If they're not, you've got to be a bit brutal and you've got to let them go. Because there is no point in employing people who just want a job. There's some very interesting interview technique I used to see. Old Morgan Evans, who I've talked about, he used to sit down with dark glasses on with the window behind him, so he was in silhouette, and say, tell me about your life in 3.5 minutes. And all he was looking for was words like, I achieved this, I did that. People who say, well, I was part of the team, or I was responsible for, I did it, but in fact they didn't. And after 3.5 minutes, he'd say, ask any question you like. And the only question he was looking for is, what do I have to do to get the job?
Oh, I love that.
And people say, what's the pension thing like? What's the holiday thing? He wasn't interested at all. All he wanted to know was, could you sell yourself? Because ultimately, that's what you have to do. You have to sell yourself.
I want you to crow for a bit. What is it you think you have that has made you so successful as a CEO and turning businesses around?
I think I have realized I love seeing other people succeed. That's really, the money, yeah, it's important. Everybody wants to. But if I give you an example, one of the last companies I ran for George, we were losing hundreds of thousands a month.
George Cukors.
Yeah, for George Cukors. This was one of the private investments he had, and I'll talk to him about the private office later. And I went up to Scotland, and actually I went up to close it down because I don't care how much money you had. You know, if you're losing hundreds of thousands a month.
No, you don't lose people's money, yeah.
You shouldn't be doing it. And I rung up George after I'd been there a week and I said, I need $500,000 and I'll turn this around for you. So he was bankrupt. He was losing
money. Wow, what changed your mind?
I saw 40% of people who were dedicated to this thing, absolutely. And other people who didn't know what they were doing. It was being run by people who didn't understand what they were doing. We gave half of the company away to the people who were running it, saying, yours, you can have it for free, off you go. And then I got rid of quite a lot of people, but I found the right people in there. Some of them were relatively young, junior consultants. And I will look back absolutely now and say some of those people ended up as the COO.
You're describing what today's culture describes as a servant leader.
I think I'm a believer in people. Ultimately, that's what it is. I believe I'm good at picking those people. Yeah, we all made mistakes. You were talking about, what have I done wrong? I can think of some people I've employed and thought, what did I do? I've woken up 2 weeks later and thought, that was the most stupid thing I've ever done in my life. But I think what I have done is I've been fixing companies by going back to basics and believing in the people who are in that company. I think there are people who can build companies because they're fantastic leaders. I think I'm a fantastic supporter of the people who... I'm able to bring out of the good people the best in them, which makes the company move. I mean, this company that was bankrupt and we went up to close down, We sold it for $25 million 2 years ago.
What's the...
It's not a huge amount.
2 years ago.
It's not a huge amount of money, but letting from zero to $25 million in 7 years is not bad.
Oh, that's good.
Do you think you have that running through your veins, or have you been like a business sponge and you have learnt from your George Cukases, the Peter Cadburys and people like that? Or is it a bit of both?
I think it's a mixture. I think it's a bit of both, because I think what I've learned through my career has allowed me to see the best in people and what they do and to bring it out in them.
How have you managed that type of personality?
George was an extraordinary fellow. He was unusual. I ran, as you said, the Cookies Holdings, which is his family office. The family office was divided into three parts. There was his money side, his life, and the direct investments he had made. And when I joined him, we had 32 direct investments. We skinned those down. Some of them we lost money on, some of them we made money on, some of them probably still there. Well, some of them are still there and making money. But what I learned from him was how to manage the expectation of the people who would go to him and say, oh, I'm really nice to meet you, George. I've got this wonderful plan and all I need is $5 million in 2 years and I'll make you a fortune. Well, everybody knew it was going to take $15 million, take 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years, double it.
And he would end up being the owner of it, rather than anything else. But, you know, when the whole internet.com boom, everything, everybody thought things worked differently. They don't. Companies run on basic things. You've got to sell, because if you don't sell, nothing happens. You know, people say, oh, yeah, but you do it over the internet. Yeah, you still got to present it, you know. There was an interesting thing we used to do in SSA. Richard would say, all those in sales stand up, and anybody who's remained standing was to let go. Because actually, we're all salespeople. From the person who cleans the office to the receptionist to whatever. Now, in a traditional sales role or marketing role, that's not true. But the principle was, if you don't sell, something grossly happens. And the answer is nothing happens.
So what was your title at that point with under George Cukas?
Under George Cukas, that was always the CEO of Cukas Holdings.
That's a big role, but, Julian,
well, it
isn't
is,
it?
But you've got to understand, it was just his private investments that I was worrying about. It wasn't his money in the money market all his life.
Yeah, I get that. You were sent up to close that company down and you said, I need $500,000. How long was that $500,000 supposed to last?
3 months.
3 months. But back in the 90s, that would have been...
No, this was in 2000.
In 2011,
I think.
Oh, 2011, yeah. Okay. That is, somebody's still got to put, a lot of faith in you, where he's on paper, this needs to be shut, this needs to be closed. You go up there and you have the ability to pick up the phone to somebody like that and say, I need 500, and you know, there, and put your neck on the line.
But think where this comes from. He made that investment originally. And like a lot of wealthy people, they don't like failure. So it was easier for me to go, because I actually suggested going to close it, not him. I mean, because that's not what he wanted to do. He would hate to admit that he got it wrong.
Yeah.
So saying to him, I need another $500,000, gave him, you could say, a lifeline to say I didn't make the wrong decision, which he didn't, actually.
True.
I thought it was a very strange company. In fact, I came to adore it in the end. But it is, there's a sort of quirk in there where, if whoever it is, whether it's George or any of the families, has made a decision to put some money in, they'll go a long way before throwing that money away.
I'm sure it's public knowledge, but I'm just intrigued, just hazard a guess. What sort of money do you think a man like that was worth, is worth?
Well, sadly, he passed away in 2024.
Right. Okay.
But if
what
he,
are we talking? He, is he a billionaire?
No, probably not. Somebody in $300 and $500 million.
What is your risk of mitigation like? You will go through in your mind a checklist very quickly after years of doing it to acid test the risk profile of this investment.
I think you need to look very carefully at what the revenues are. Are there any revenues? I mean, the younger the company, the higher the risk. And in my mind, I would look at something really early stage that he'd put money into and say, in my mind, regardless of what he decides to put into it, I think this is worth a punt or another $500,000, $5 million, whatever it might be. One of the big problems with direct investment by wealthy individuals like that is that you go in with $5 million and
you're up to 10 5 minutes later.
Well, yeah, you take 20% of the company. Then COVID comes along and they haven't got any money. And so you end up putting 15 in, but now you earn 70% of the company. And the problem is that there are probably three founders, so they all own 10% each. Suddenly, you've got a company that's working well and they're all being paid nice salaries, and they don't want to sell because they lose their job when you sell. And they're not going to get a huge amount of money out of it. They might get 5 years' worth of pay. So they'd rather actually what I call a comfort company. They'd rather carry on running it as a small company. Well, that's not why George invested. It becomes a dilemma of a thing. Now, as long as they own a big enough chunk that when you sell, they get, you know, piss off money, if you'll excuse the expression, that's fine. But when the money they're going to get isn't worth more than 5 years' their salary,
of course,
the whole thing begins to turn the other way around.
Julian, talk me through some of the things you've got wrong.
Oh, I think I've learned that I can be over-arrogant in the long run. I think I've probably been less interested in the new way of things as life has turned since the year 2000. It hasn't done me badly, Richard. I've stuck to my old principles, like how you sell and what you do and how you manage a company, yeah, which has done me well. But I suspect, I hate to admit it, that there have been quite a few opportunities in the modern economy that I've missed because I'm a bit stuck in my old ways.
Okay, that's honest.
But you're a very wealthy man.
No.
Well, this is a man that says that 25 million isn't a lot of money. Yeah. So, no, he was a pauper.
Unfortunately, it's not mine. I've had a successful life and I'm very comfortable.
Okay, so Julian Sturton is 18 years old today, right? And he's coming into the world as we know it now with internet and tech and everything else and Instagram and this, that and the other. Does Julian Sturton make the same success of his life?
I know friends now who say, my CV doesn't even get looked at unless I've got a master's or a decent degree. I think the world is missing out on some very clever people who were like me.
I couldn't agree with you more.
That's the way things are. And getting that interview to get past the door is the most important
thing. And there's no old boys network now, really.
The old boys network is gone. Not that I ever really used that. I mean, you know, I fell into the Cambridge job.
But it might just get you at least some job experience or something. Exactly. And then it's up to you.
It's a lot harder. So if I was 18 now, I would go and get a degree. But my goodness me, I would advise anybody to get a degree in something that was really relevant. I'm sure a literary degree or an art degree is wonderful. But let me tell you, even when I was looking at CVs, if he had an MBA, it did went straight over my head. I couldn't give a damn because they either knew what they were doing and all the letters in the alphabet after your name wouldn't have impressed me.
You are Mr. Fix-It for companies. There's no one clearly to me that does it better than you have. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. You've turned around multiple companies. Could you have started your own and built it? Because surely you know all the answers, don't you?
Would you have wanted to?
I think the answer, would I want to, probably never came into my head because I was having too much fun with somebody else's money fixing them.
Yeah, you're probably earning enough as well.
Well, I mean, one is driven by money, but I am not driven like probably somebody in the financial sector who just wants to be paid more than the next guy. I want to be able to enjoy my life, and I think that's important. You can lose sight of that if you're not careful.
That is the separation of a pure CEO and an entrepreneur. Yeah. Were you away from home a lot?
Oh, yeah, I used to travel an enormous amount. And the biggest worry I ever carried was paying the payroll.
We've ascertained that you probably wouldn't have wanted to start your own. But what if you did?
I think it's much easier to look in from the outside to fix something. The other thing I am conscious about is that in all the fixing I've done, I'm not a big growth guy. I can get the thing going well, but if you ask me to take a $25 million company and turn it into a quarter of a billion dollar company, that's not me. There are people who are better than that. And I think if you look in your life, you know, if you have any money, you give it to a money manager. Because I tell you what, they screw it up, even though they're professionals at it. So the opportunity for you to do it yourself are even bigger. So I think one of the important things is to recognize your limitations. Mm-hmm. But in doing that, it also helps you recognize the limitations in the people who are working for you. You know, the constant thing was people would ask, can I be the CEO or can I inherit the CEO or the CFO or the COO from you? And you have to say no. We have a great friend who has been asked continuously to bump up from wealth management into running something huge. He consistently says no. for two reasons. The first is he loves his clients and his clients love him. And the second is everybody knows you do that job for 2 years and you get fired.
A bit like a football manager, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, he is absolutely brilliant at what he does. And effectively, he runs the thing.
So how do you become a CEO? What is the natural entry? COO, is it, or it's CFO, or is it MD?
Well, CEO and MD are the same thing. I mean, as far as I'm concerned,
okay.
Ultimately, you're not the chairman. The chairman's the job that, if you look at what's happening at Apple now, he's done his time. Cook's going on to be the executive chairman, which means he's not involved day to day, really. And it needs fresh blood and all the rest of it. It's an interesting product decision, but there you go. But I think people...
Why do you say that?
Well, I think Apple have been slow in the whole AI business. They're relatively slow. And this is not me speaking, this is picking up from everything. And they've always been a product company. And one of the reasons we buy our phones and our computers is they're lovely things to own.
Yeah.
You know, they're nicer than anything else.
Yeah.
And in the days when everything is AI, and frankly, who cares about what it runs on? The new CEO who comes from a product background, it will be interesting to see whether they actually need a technology guy rather than a product.
Interesting.
I think people believe that they need to go to, whether if it's, you know, if they're the deputy CEO, they need to go to the CEO, or if they're this, they need to go up to one. People believe that that's a career that they want to go up to, but quite a lot of people fail or get fired because actually that's not what they're really good at. If I fall back on this friend, he knows his real expertise is in what he does. And he wouldn't enjoy that job, even though everybody would say, well, you should go for it because it's that's your career path. You know, honestly speaking, is that really good for everybody? It takes a very brave person to sit down and say, what am I good at? And what should I be doing? And I think if you look at quite a lot of, sometimes it's because judges are an example. You know, people are really good lawyers and then they get made up to a QC or a KC, I suppose they are now. And they loathe it. First of all, they take a pay cut, which is a bit of a shock to them. And secondly, they have to actually make that decision at the end of the court. Whereas what they're really happy to do is fighting. They love the challenge of the battle, of fighting for the thing. That is a real example. If you've got the guts to say, actually, I'm enjoying what I do more than I would.
I think that's the core foundation of often mum and dad companies, where you've got two co-founders, or lucky enough that you've got two effectively strangers who come together to be co-founders. Is the core of it is that both of them recognise that the other one's strength is their weakness,
yeah.
And the other one's and their that's strength
true.
Is the other.
Absolutely.
That makes a very dynamic company, and often is the...
So is that why you're successful, you two?
Do you know, it's why my ex-husband...
I'm going to flip this interview over.
I know that it's why
you've done
my
that very
ex-husband
successfully.
And I were successful in what we did. And we rose, you know, we dominated our industry. All your risk assessments, you never once mentioned. I sat down with the co-founders or the founder and found out who they were.
Generally speaking, they were part of the problem. One of those sort of golden rules is never buy into a company where the CEO wants to leave. Because there's a good reason.
There's a good reason. Or the CFO, then you know there's a bad situation.
So it seems so obvious that, doesn't it?
But I think there's a second stage. Realizing what strength and weakness is the first thing. Admitting it publicly, effectively, is the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
Because I am not a CFO in any chance. I need a really good numbers person behind me.
Yeah.
And I would never tend to be. And if I find the right person, that was what supported me. I could ask a number and they would give it to me.
Yeah.
And I can perhaps add a bit of tinsel to it, make it look a bit better. You only realize this when you take a step backwards. I spent 30 years fixing companies, big, small, indifferent, building things. But I never understood really when I did it. I didn't sit down and analyze, what am I doing here? I just said, I can see that's a problem. I'll fix that. And that would lead you on to another thing.
Julian,
I don't have a plan.
You say you're not a numbers man. When you look at a P&L, does that jump out at you, glaringly obvious, what needs to, just by looking at that?
Well, some things do, but I think numbers people can dress companies very differently.
Before, you could hide behind a brand and the brand would do the talking and the movement and the salesperson would lead, you know, the front facing for the cold face of clients. CEOs now are expected to be storytellers And they are expected to have social media that is of a caliber that effectively creates an authentic presence and solidifies confidence in shareholders, which I think is a real added pressure.
When I worked for Temenos, luckily as CEO, I was operations rather than driving the company. But the CEO did nothing but build for the next quarterly report.
Yeah, horrendous.
I mean, he was extraordinary when George stepped up as chairman. He put this gentleman in and said, extraordinarily successful. I mean, he took Temenos from its 150 million turnover to its 3 billion or whatever it is, or 7 billion. I mean, he did an unbelievable job. It was very, very hard. And he was a very tough taskmaster. In 7 years of monthly reporting, I only got one which said, you know what your business is doing. Every other one was critical. Wow. But he drove it. But, you know, hats off to him. Absolutely impressive. Really impressive. And George could never have done that. He was far too good of a people person. Whereas this other fellow was a proper, proper CEO. Tough as old boots. But I think the quarterly reporting has driven some people to some very poor decisions.
Julian, does the product have to be that good? The old Gerald Ratner moment.
Oh my God, look at that.
And actually, very rarely these days is it possible to bring out anything new anyway?
You buy your phone. If you've got a problem with it, you walk into an Apple store and somebody helps you fix it. And that's why we do it, because we know. Now, I don't know where you take your Samsung phone to get it fixed. I mean, yeah, you can have the glass replaced or
isn't
something like that. But if you think about
it, absolutely true.
People buy from people. Remember that. That's what everybody said from time immemorial. People buy from people. And if you take the banking system or something, on a Friday night when it's not working, if somebody comes in and fixes it over the weekend when banks were shut on Saturdays and Sundays, that's worth more than the best product in the world that breaks down on Friday night and nothing gets fixed till Monday. If people trust you that it's going to work,
yeah,
a lot of it's psychology from that point of view.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I've been lucky. I was presented with opportunities in my life and I made probably the best ones. I will tell you a funny story because this
Please do.
In about 2000, I was offered a job working for this was in the dot-com boom, and came with 275,000 share options at $3 a pop. This was unpublic. It was, you know, that was what it was. And I didn't take it. And it went public about 6 months later at $23 a go. And at the end of that day, it was $103 a day. And in my mind, I had missed the opportunity on $27 million. Now, there was a lockout period. And at the end of the lockout period, the shares were worth $3.75.
Oh, my God.
So I hadn't. But that weekend, I was moaning and groaning. And my wife said, next time that happens, go and stay in a hotel.
Yeah. What a story.
But that was an opportunity I didn't take. And in hindsight, just as well. Yeah. But let me tell you, that weekend, I thought I had thrown away that one opportunity in life I had to make a lot of money. Sometimes you fall on your face. I mean, I've been made redundant 3 times in my life.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
You've been fired?
Yep, I have been fired. Once because the company was closing down. Another time because somebody very senior admitted to me that they were having an affair with somebody else in the company, which I didn't know and I didn't need to know. But once they'd admitted it, I apparently was...
Oh, you had to go. Down. Wow.
But even that was fun because they paid me a lot of money and I bought myself an old car.
You strike me as somebody that looks back on a wonderful career.
The brain, I think, in life forgets the bad things in life, unless there's a really traumatic event. We all remember the good times. We tend not to remember the bad times. I look at everything as it did have a good result. You know, had I not joined Peter Cadbury for as long as I did, I probably would have ended up in the city and I probably would have been richer. But would I have been happier? Who knows?
Yeah.
But I'm really grateful for what's happened to me. I have been very lucky. And the luckiest thing is I made the right choices. I feel I've done okay.
You're on death row.
Yep.
You've closed too many businesses.
You've been taken by wife, haven't you?
You've closed and fired and shut too many businesses, right? So... in fact, you haven't just fired everyone, you've killed them. So you're on death row. What is your last meal before you hit the electric chair?
That's a very interesting one. What would I eat? What would I really like?
It's always the men that love this question.
Well, I just
look at him licking his lips.
I'm just thinking, what would I really like to eat? I think I'd like a really good bowl of soup.
What? Really?
Do you know, I have this theory that, and just hear me out on this, that the best food can be eaten with a fork or a spoon. You don't need a knife. And I say that because
Interesting.
Well, that's comfort food, soup. I once had a steak in Barcelona, which I didn't need a knife to cut. And it was the best steak I've ever had.
Wow.
And it just made me think, because I love soups. I mean, I really do.
Soup can be
any flavour in the world, can't it? You can do anything.
But we're not talking about Heinz soup. We're talking about
I mean,
someone has cooked you a wholesome hearty.
I don't know if you remember, you know, in the 80s, a lot of people used to cook for businesses in the city.
Yes.
And invariably, at the end of the week, they get all the leftovers, they just stick in the Magi Mix and produce these. Yeah. You could never reproduce them, but they were just fantastic.
Everybody honestly says something different. Julian Sturton, you have been an absolute pleasure to have as a guest. And
very
I
humble.
Know that a lot of our listeners and viewers will take a lot from what you've been talking about today. Thank you for coming on Entrepreneurs Worldwide.
Thank you. Enjoy.
Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.